my advice to people that feel a little uneasy with the selling part, I recommend that they do the following. When you are creating a work of art, completely eliminate from your mind any thoughts of marketing or business. Don't create a painting that is blue because blue has been selling like crazy. That's not the reason why you should create the painting. Create the painting because you're inspired to create it, and be authentic to your inspiration. Now, once you put that brush down, it's business time.
This is a Cracking Creativity Podcast, episode number 39 with Juan Sepulveda. Welcome to the Cracking Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Jones, and I'm here to show you how creatives turn their ideas into action, create interesting projects, and build an engaged audience with their shared passions. Now let's get creative. In this episode of the Cracking Creativity Podcast, I talk to Juan Sepulveda, who is a painter and the creator of the Winding Stairs podcast and the Gentleman's Brotherhood. His art focuses around the lessons and symbols of Freemasonry. In it, Juan talks about creating your art and marketing it, and why you need to change hats when you do it, why you have to have the right mindset when approaching everything you do, and why you need to diversify your income streams if you want to make it as an artist. Now on to the episode. Welcome to another episode of Cracking Creativity. Today I've on Juan Sepulveda, and he is a 32nd degree Rite Scottish Master Mason. He is the host of the Winding Stairs. He is an artist. He is the host of the newly created Gentleman's Brotherhood and the Masonic Roundtable. These are many different things to what you're doing, all focused around, I guess, principles and things of that nature. Juan, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, some of what you're doing, and what you're doing in the world?
Thank you very much, Kevin, for having me on your show. I really appreciate it. It is a great pleasure. Basically, all of these are things that have lined up with how I look at life. I've always been interested in self-development and taking steps to improve myself, but not leave it at that. I've always looked to take what I learn and help other people in their own journey. And that is why I've become involved in these particular ventures. So that's, you know, what the things that I do with the Winding Stairs. I describe it as a program dedicated to Masonic education and the art of self-improvement. So people don't have to be Freemasons in order to enjoy the messages that are contained within the program. I speak there about different virtues and morality and behaviors that can help any man, regardless of their upbringing, religious belief, or political views, help them become better versions of themselves. And with the Gentleman's Brotherhood, I took it a step further, and I made it more specific to helping men become more in tune with good manners and politeness. I find it unfortunate that more and more I find that people don't have empathy, and I come across people who are abrasive unnecessarily. And I think it's important for there to be a place where men can go and learn more about what the proper way to behave in different circumstances is. I find my information from various sources, but I think that it's important for there to be almost like a single hub where people can go and find out what's the proper etiquette for doing one thing or expressing yourself. So that's basically the premise of the Gentleman's Brotherhood.
Cool. Can you tell me how you got started into becoming a Freemason and really how you ended up where you are? Because the journey, it seems to be like it would be a very interesting road to get to where you are now.
Yes. Well, when I was growing up, I had an uncle who really inspired me. He was a very respected man. He was professionally very, he had achieved a lot of things and he was respected. And in the personal life, he was very good at speaking with people and showing compassion, showing empathy and almost living in an inspiring way. And my father and him, they're, like I say, they're cut from the same cloth, and they both shared that. They both share those characteristics. But there was something about my uncle that I really appreciated, and it was the way in which he expressed himself. And when I think I was about 17 years old, my grandmother died. And when she passed away, during the funeral, a man stood up and started giving like an eulogy and started singing praises about how great my grandmother was, how much of a great leader she was, that she raised the family almost by herself. And she, well, after all, the man went on and on singing praises about her. And then he shifted gears and he said, well, it's no mystery then why Jose, which is my uncle, is such a great man, such a great role model. As all of you know, he is a master. He's a master mason, and he's the master of our lodge, blah, 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 blah. At the time, I knew nothing about Freemasonry. So I was like, what is he talking about? What is this thing that he belongs to that I don't know? And there's a marked difference when it comes to discretion in regards to Freemasonry in the United States and in other countries. For example, in Puerto Rico, people are a little bit more discreet. You don't see a lot of people wearing the Masonic rings or having stickers on their car, whereas here in the States, you'll see a much more open expression of membership. So it took me by surprise that he was a Mason, and I knew nothing about it. So I started doing some research and asked him a couple of times to speak to me about it, but he was very discreet. And he would tell me, well, come another day, we'll sit down, just you and I, and I'll talk to you about it. But I almost took that as, you know, no, you don't need to know anything about this. I read into the whole thing that he was just dismissing my inquiry. But as years went by, I moved to the States, and I came here to Florida in the year 1999. And I started doing more research about Freemasonry, and I eventually picked up the phone and called a local lodge and asked them, I want to know more about what this fraternity is, what I've read I like, and I don't have anybody to help me. So they invited me to come in to a meeting, answered all my questions, asked me a few questions of their own, and eventually I filled out a petition and was accepted. Which a lot of people think that in order for you to become a Freemason, you have to be invited. And such is not the case. You have to ask a Mason to become a Mason, basically. So that's what I did. I'm glad I asked, though, because I've really enjoyed the whole journey.
Why do you think there are these perceptions of Freemasonry that people have without really knowing what it actually is?
Well, in my opinion, one of the biggest thing is that Freemasonry as a whole has had this stance that for people that are antagonists of what we practice, we don't go out there and confront them. We don't go out in public and try to justify or be apologists. We just don't deal with it. The people who have an interest or admire what we do, we spend our time with them. And for the longest time, that was the attitude. And that might have been fine during the age of just the printing press. But now anybody can open up a blog and start writing all kinds of nonsense and attributing misinformation and perpetuating, actually, in misinformation that has been passed down from people to people. And it's exponential, the growth of the internet, and by the same token, it's exponential, the growth of the things that people say that are incorrect. So we have, as an organization, for the past 5 years or so, some people have taken the initiative to actually put out credible information that is, how can I say this? It's credible information that can, instead of refuting what other people are saying that's negative, it just shows, you know, this is the truth. This is what we do. This is what we practice. And I think it's beneficial. For example, the podcast that I put together dispels some of these myths and some of these misbeliefs. And I think it's important for people to come to their own conclusion once they have found information in a credible source, as opposed to just reading what any kid puts in a blog or writes in a magazine just for popularity.
Mm-hmm. So. I also want to touch upon your story as an artist, because you talked about it in your speech that you gave to our podcast group here in Orlando, and I thought that was a pretty interesting story and how you got from that story to actually becoming an artist.
Well, In the presentation that I gave, I shared a very specific moment where I was in a crossroads. I was about to graduate from high school, and I had to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. So I had two things that were prominent in my life, two things that I could see myself doing for the rest of my life. One was related to aviation. I wanted to be a pilot. And the other one is that I recognized that I was talented in the visual arts, and I thought that I could do something good with it. However, I didn't see a lot of prospects for having a good art career. I don't think there weren't that many opportunities to be financially sustainable as an artist. So I went for that first option. I wanted to become a pilot. And in the story, I explained that I reached out to this man who was a pilot, who I admired. He was a very respected man in my neighborhood, lovely family, a beautiful house in a nice neighborhood. And I thought, well, let me reach out to him because he was a private pilot. He should have the answers that I need to take the right steps to become a pilot myself. But little did I know, he was very jaded towards the profession of being a pilot. So he proceeded to systematically, with every word that came out of his mouth, he proceeded to just destroy my ambition to be a pilot. He just gave me every single objection. And I don't know if it was a test of my determination to be a pilot, or if he really was that bitter about it. So I was very impressionable at the time, and I took his words seriously. And so I shifted gears, and I then went to my second option, which was art. But in school, my education is marketing. That's what I ended up graduating for. So most of my my artistic skills were developed in outside of school. It was by myself or practicing. I partnered with other people that had skills that I was lacking, so I practiced with them or listened to their instruction and moved my style further. But it was that moment, it was that day that I spoke with that man that my whole artistic career kind of shifted into high gear.
I think one of the good points that you made during that presentation was that at every moment we are projecting out towards people information, and we don't know how people are going to interpret how we're acting, so it's always good to be aware of what you're doing and how that is having an effect on people.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. Because you might take it as you're giving your opinion, but the person that is in the receiving end, they might be attributing so much importance to your opinion that it could change their life. So it is a responsibility that we might not be asking for, but nevertheless, it's right there, and we need to be responsible with it.
So how did you go from graduating with a degree in marketing into building a career as an artist?
Well, before I graduated, the reason I moved to Florida was because I thought that since I wanted to find a career as an artist, I started thinking, what artists or what branches of art I know I can do and I can make a living out of. So my main idea was to become an animator. And if you want to be an animator, well, back in the 90s, if you wanted to be an animator, you came here. So that's what I did. I came to Florida. I worked for Disney I wasn't an artist. I just came through a college program. And I just wanted to be close to the animators. And it was very beneficial because as a cast member, I had access to go to different workshops, different speeches that professional animators and directors were given. So I had a chance to have one-on-one conversations or be part of a forum that explored that professional side of animation. But once I spent enough time looking at that world, I recognized that the whole nature of the process, it didn't line up with my artistic inclinations. I don't know how much, you know, for people that don't know a lot about the process of animation, you have some lead animators that create the key movements in an animation. And there's a group of artists who are called the in-betweeners, and they create all the fractions of a movement between one keyframe and the other. So the artist is making dozens of drawings that all look the same. There's no room for the artist to insert his own interpretation or his own creativity. He's just replicating what somebody else made. And that was that's the first step you take into being an animator. You become an in-betweener, among other things. But for what I wanted to do, that was my only step in. And I just did not see myself doing that. I'm more of an independent thinker. I like solving problems. I don't like necessarily repeating something over and over again. So that continued my chase for there has to be something related to art that I can do and still make a living. And I started looking more at the fine art aspect. That's when the light bulb went off. I was like, that's where it is. Because there, it's just me creating my vision from concept to execution. And then I am passionate about business because my father was a businessman and my education was marketing. So now that I have my unique creation made. Now it's time for me to switch hats and become the businessman and see how I can then put this in the hands of people that identify with the message contained in the painting. And that first exposure to the fine arts, that's when I saw, okay, this is where I'm heading. So I put all my eggs in that basket, and I haven't looked back since.
Interesting. What kinds of things did they teach you in these closed animation or workshop classes that they taught at Disney?
Well, I remember we had one, I think he was a lead animator for the movie Mulan, which was, it had just come out at that time. And he basically gave a presentation where he showed the components of the movie that he was involved in, and he explained the different roles of the different people that worked in the movie. So he gave those kinds of workshops would allow the cast members to see the potential positions that they could move into if they were interested in working in that. Or just for the people that were just curious about the whole process, it's a real treat for you to speak with a real Disney animator. So that's where I was able to learn more about the whole process and see how they do it. They would show you like live demonstrations and show you physical examples of what their work looked like. And I think that was very helpful, especially since when you're at the beginning of any career, you have no idea how things are done.
Mm-hmm.
You see the right? You see the final product, and you know that somebody has to draw something, but how does it make it into the film? And they were able to show you the steps in the different roles. So that was an eye-opener right there.
I think an interesting thing about that is for just about anyone who looks up to somebody, they see that person and think, oh, man, how can you possibly get to that position?
Yeah.
But what they didn't realize is that person spent probably 10 years trying to get there.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like when people talk about overnight success. Well, sometimes overnight success takes 10 years.
I think every overnight success takes at least a few years.
Right. So I was fortunate that I spent enough time analyzing or thinking, is this a viable direction for me to take? Not just can I do it, but also will I enjoy doing it? And that has been a very important barometer for my life. I try to pick things that I know I'm going to enjoy. There's no sense in spending time doing things that you really don't like. I know that in terms of skills, if I wanted to be an animator, I could have become an animator. But I had to be honest with myself, is, you know, prestige aside, because it would have been great to say, oh, I'm a Disney animator. With that aside, would I really enjoy the grind? Would I enjoy that daily format of creativity? And I had to be honest with myself that no, I personally would not have been happy going in that direction. So I kept on looking for the alternatives of, it had to be related to art because I knew that that's what I had to do. And I started working for Weiland Galleries. You know the artist Weiland? He's a marine artist. And he has galleries all over the world. So they had galleries in Celebration, Boardwalk, and Disney's Boardwalk. They had all over Central Florida. And they gave me an opportunity to work in their framing department. I learned a ton there. I've saved thousands of dollars in framing by having taken that position. But more importantly, I had a chance to actually meet the artists that I idolized in the galleries. Roy Gonzalez Tabora, Weiland, Jim Warren, James Coleman. Like, these people were legends to me. They were people that I really admire, and I had a chance to meet them personally, see how they actually did their work. Where they, the process of sketching a painting, painting it, and then putting it in the hands of a printer and going through that process and doing limited edition reproduction, et cetera, et cetera. That, when I saw that, I was like, okay, that's what I like. I like that idea.
Yeah. Why do you think people stick to things that they don't enjoy as opposed to trying to find a thing that they might enjoy?
Well, it could be many different things. I know that some people might feel the responsibility to have the structure of a 9-to-5 job. They might feel that that's what you have to do. And it could be because they grew up in an era where that was the norm. I think more and more today, there's a more openness to be more entrepreneurial. And I could be completely off on this, but that's how I see it. I think that there's more acceptance, and frankly, there's a lot more opportunities for people to do their own thing, you know, with the access to the internet and communications. Like, we didn't have to get in a car to do this. We're in two different offices, and we're having a conversation that we're recording, and we're going to share with people from all over the place. excuse me. So some people might feel that obligation to do that, to follow what somebody else has established, especially for in the arts. It is tricky to make a living as an artist because there has to be a business component that is injected into it. Mm-hmm. And whether it comes from your own business education or business acumen, or do you submit yourself to the help of other people, or you surround yourself with people that can help you with the business aspect, but nevertheless, that business aspect has to be there. Otherwise, there isn't going to be any living being made.
Mm-hmm.
And that's difficult. I have a lot of friends that are artists, and they are, the ones that are successful are the ones that do one of those two things. Either they're good at changing hats from, you know, they change from their artist beret to the business hat, and they do well. And the other people that do well are the ones that recognize, listen, I have no business being in business. All I can do is art, but I can put my paintings in the hand of a business person that can help me sell it. And that's how they can make it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the opposition is for those people who don't want to do marketing? Like, there are a lot of artists that are against even the thought of, like, marketing their own artwork. How do you get those people out of that mindset, and why does that mindset even exist?
Well, this is something that I've encountered a lot, and I take it very personal, because I have met people that have criticized me for being able to do what I do in selling my art, because they... Here's the thing. There are artists who look at their art in a purist kind of way, as if it's inspiration. It's almost their connection to God, and they're, you know, creating something that is bigger than themselves. And I respect that. Yes, perhaps that's the case. But once it's created, if you really want to make sure that it's in the hands of the people that are going to be affected by it, it has to be marketed. It has to be sold. And my advice to people that feel a little uneasy with the selling part, I recommend that they do the following. When you are creating a work of art, completely eliminate from your mind any thoughts of marketing or business. Don't create a painting that is blue because blue has been selling like crazy. That's not the reason why you should create the painting. Create the painting because you're inspired to create it, and be authentic to your inspiration. Now, once you put that brush down, it's business time. Now you need, and if you think about it this way, let's say you have a message that you want to deliver through your painting. A lot of my paintings, and you'll see those when you visit the website or see the show notes, you'll see that a lot of the paintings that I create, I have a message in particular that I want to give people. And I'll give you an example. One of the most popular paintings that I ever made is called Opportunity. And in it, you see a long hallway that becomes darker as it recedes into the distance. And there are doors lining that hallway on either side. There's nobody except for one man on his knees right in front of one door. And he looks devastated. He looks like he's exhausted, but he's just there on the floor right in front of one of the doors. And it's called Opportunity. And my message through it is that in our journey through life, however long it might be, however treacherous it might be, we will be presented with opportunities at every step. But those doors that are on that painting, most of them are closed, but only a couple of them, three of them, are open. More importantly, the one that's right behind the man that's on the floor is open. So it shows that as you move along through life, there will be doors that are closed. But it might take you some effort to re-energize, stand up, and continue walking until you find the opportunity that's going to open for you. I think that's a message that a lot of people should hear. Now, once I create the painting, I think it's my responsibility to put that painting in front of as many people as possible, because otherwise I consider that I'm being selfish, because I'm only keeping it to myself. And some people, I sell my originals, sell for a particular price, but I have limited edition reproductions that sell for a little bit less. And sometimes I have open edition prints just for the entry market, because I feel that the message within the painting should reach as many people as possible, regardless of their ability to pay a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I've always looked at it that way. Otherwise, I'm just serving the rich only if I'm only selling originals. But anyway, so hopefully the people that are creating and have that uneasy feeling about selling, they can recognize you need to change your hats. Don't allow business to contaminate your creativity when you're making your piece. And once that's done, now it's time to put it in front of as many people as possible. And if that means creating reproductions or doing exhibitions or opening up a Facebook page or starting an email list, it's up to you.
I have so many things to say about that. But that was great. The first is, like you said, when you're creating a painting and you sell it to somebody, that person wants it because it speaks to them in a way that you were able to convey in your art. And therefore, they're gaining joy because, like you said, you're being selfish if you don't want to sell it.
Yeah.
Because then you're just keeping it to yourself. And what is the purpose of that? Isn't the purpose of art to help spread a message or to convey a meaning and to, you know, get feelings out?
Exactly. Make people feel something. And regardless of whether the paintings are as specific with their message as the one I described is, or if it's just different shades of a color, it doesn't matter. What's your purpose And I describe my art, I say art with a purpose, because I do have a purpose. I want it to either start a conversation or motivate someone to be introspective. I really want the work to have an effect on the viewer. And many times I've been showing my work and it just, that's what it does. It starts a conversation and we can talk about the different possibilities of why is that man on the floor and like why is he so exhausted and how does that apply to my life? And those are conversations that are worth having. And if I make my paintings and just stuff them in a bag and put them in the attic, then I'm doing a disservice to the people who were intended to see the paintings.
Mm-hmm. Another thing about that that painting that you described is you were able to tell a story through your art, which is, I think, one of the most important parts of marketing and trying to sell your art, because putting that extra meaning into your work adds an additional layer on top of the art, not just a visual thing. It's multi-layered and it can be interpreted in so many different ways and start conversations about really whatever that person feeling, what you were feeling, and like what we can feel together.
Exactly. That's right. And, you know, there's another thing that I don't want to forget related to that whole, I don't know how to describe it, but that being hesitant to sell the work. I remember distinctly while I was, let me not be too specific. I don't want to offend anybody, but I remember a moment in my life where I was working with the two sides of the artist. I was working side by side with the most successful artists that I've ever known, people that were selling paintings for $26,000 that they just painted on a night. And I was working hand on hand with other people that were making, you know, as much money as I was making, a little bit over minimum wage. And there was one man who was as talented and was working for that minimum wage, and he was as talented as some of the people that he was working for. He could create exactly the same level of quality painting. I'm telling you, exactly the same amount of quality. And the one thing that made them different is that that man that was working for that minimum wage, making frames and delivering art, the only difference was that he regarded selling his art as prostitution. Hmm. And that's exactly how he expressed it, that he was selling his art. He saw it as something so negative. And hanging on, attaching himself so strongly to that belief prevented him from having the financial freedom that he could have had. And he was depriving people from looking at the paintings he created. Nobody saw those paintings except his friends and family. And paintings that were, like I said, of the same quality as the ones that were hanging in museums. And it was the only impediment was his own way of looking at it. But there was nothing that I could do about it. And I'm glad that I saw that. That I was able to witness that the only thing that made them different was that. So I chose the other.
Yeah. I think there are some things that separate people who become, I guess, successful, I guess you could call it financially, and those who aren't. One is your perception determines your reality.
Yes. What's that?
And the second is that your mindset means everything.
Absolutely. We were talking about that the other day too, about the mindset. It's you create your own limits. You know, think about this. For the listeners, take 1 second to think of the artist that you admire the most. Anyone, pick one. Your favorite painter. You know, for me, some of my favorite painters are Salvador Dali, M.C. Escher, René Magritte. These people, they had the same amount of time that you and I have. and some of them had less resources than you and I have. And look what they were able to do with that same amount of time, same amount of resources. Look at the legacy they were able to leave. The thing, we confine ourselves many times. We restrict ourselves from reaching our potential, and it's a mindset thing. There's nothing I wish more than, you know, for there to be at least one person that listens to our conversation that realizes if Picasso could put some of those ink drawings, you know, in museums, I can do that too. Mm-hmm. And enjoy it while I'm living. Because those days are over. Days of, you know, that the artwork is only valuable after you die. I refuse to be a part of
it. If you believe that, then that means it's true for you.
That's right. You just made it real.
I want to talk about how you took this idea of Freemasonry and the Winding Stairs and were able to use that as the intersection between that world and the art world.
Well, Freemasonry is I find this to be the most beautiful description of Freemasonry, is that Freemasonry is a science of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. In other words, we share stories about morality, about being a virtuous man, about being a better man, by telling very specific stories, memorable stories that are going to stay ingrained in the mind of the man who witnessed them. And then those allegories or those stories are represented by symbols. So when you see the square and the compasses in the front of a building or in someone's car or in their ring, excuse me, what you're seeing is the symbolic representation of a life-changing lesson. And for those who are curious, the square and the compasses represent, the square represents the square of virtue that reminds us to be upright, to be square in our dealings, to be men of honor. And then the compass helps us circumscribe our passions and desires. So we draw a circle around ourselves and keep our passions under control. And that's basically what that means. When you see those symbols, that's what it means. And when I see them in my ring, I'm reminded about that stuff. So think about how powerful it is to just see an illustration that can help me be a better dad and help me be a better husband. And this is not exclusive to Freemasonry. This is something that many organizations enjoy. So there's power in a symbol. So when I joined Freemasonry, I started becoming exposed to a lot of art related to the lessons contained within Freemasonry. And I was very inspired by it. And it was almost as if I couldn't wait. Once I was initiated, I wanted to be able to also create art that represented those lessons. And little by little, that's how it started. The first collection that I created it just for me. I thought, how cool would it be if I could have this symbol and that symbol and the other symbol, but have them like this. And I created a collection of ink drawings on parchment, and they are shaded with charcoal and chalk. And I just thought it was cool. I just thought it was something that I wanted to have on my wall, so I created it. And as I shared it with people from within the fraternity, they really liked them, and they started asking, oh my God, I like them. Can you make copies of them? And at the moment, I was already making a living as an artist, so I was already making paintings and creating limited edition reproductions of those. And I thought, oh yeah, I even had the equipment. I had the large format printers and all that good stuff. So I decided, yeah, I can definitely do that. and we were looking for fundraiser opportunities within my lodge. And I suggested I can make copies of these for us to sell to the other members of the organization, and a portion of that can go to help raise funds. Now, the response from people was so good that even members of other lodges were asking about the prints. And I saw, well, if these two different groups liked it, maybe if I share them online with other people, they might take a liking to them as well. And that's how this whole thing was born. And now my Masonic collection, I've shipped it around the world. I have it in Australia and Mexico and the UK, Canada, basically all the states in the United States. And oftentimes it adorns lodges. So when people go to their own meetings, they are my paintings are in the walls. So, but it all started like that. It started with me creating something because I liked it, because I was inspired to create it. And then it wasn't until later on that, let's say, the sharing it became almost organic, and it grew from there.
I think oftentimes when you start with something that speaks to you specifically, you are actually tapping into like a universal truth that other people will also find inspiring. So
that's true.
Instead of trying to create something specifically like, oh, I don't know, Kim Kardashian's in style, let me do a painting of her.
Exactly.
Let me do a painting that speaks to me, and that will in turn speak to other people.
Exactly. And for me, I remember distinctly, I created one painting as a result of what I had noticed I had sold previously. And I thought, well, these dimensions sold better, these colors, these theme. And when I was creating that painting, the only thing I was thinking is, if I combine this size with these colors and these objects, I'm going to sell these like crazy. Boy, was I wrong. I couldn't even finish a darn thing because I hated it. It wasn't – I wasn't being genuine. I wasn't being honest with even with myself. I'm creating something with the strategy of selling many pieces of it, but I wasn't inspired to create it. And right now, that piece still exists. Only a handful of people have seen a portion of it, because I ended up cutting it, reversing it, and using that canvas to paint something else. So the back of one of my paintings that has taken, you know, other people have liked, the back of it is that reminder to me not to do that nonsense again.
I think art is one of those few things where you can't create a formula. Many things in life you can like create a formula and just reproduce it to get the outcome that you want. But art, I think, needs to speak to you, or else you're not going to want to do it. It's not that it won't work. It might work.
Yeah.
But do you really want to create it?
That's true. And I'm glad that I had that experience, because it prevents me from trying that again. Because it didn't matter how much I tried to fix it, it was going nowhere. It really was going nowhere. And I made the right decision to not finish it, and to keep it like I did, because now it serves as a reminder to be true to myself and connect to that creative source and only create things that fulfill me, because those are the pieces that people really identify with. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. Before we started this talk, you told me that you wanted to mention an element that everyone needs to use to make a living for themselves, and that is to have multiple income streams. So you have the Winding Stairs, you have the Gentleman's Brotherhood, and I know you also said you do speaking.
Yes.
Can you talk about that and how you can kind of use multiple things instead of just the paintings themselves to create income for yourself so that you can continue to create?
Yes. Well, if one thing that is clear is that art sales are not a steady income. It's something that even for people who are professionals at selling their art, it has its fluctuations. You have months that are very good and you have months that are not so good. So having diversified sources of income helps you maintain more of a stability. And, you know, throw in also the complexities of life. If you have a growing family, or if you have other things to tend to, it is more important that you have different sources from which your income is arriving. For me, it has evolved throughout the years. And currently, I generate an income by doing public speaking and by selling my paintings. But when I started and I invested money in reproduction equipment, I was doing graphic design, I was doing reproductions for artists, I was consulting with artists, helping them start their own art business, I was selling paintings, I was doing a lot of different things. And when one of those was producing well, perhaps the other ones weren't, and vice versa. But the importance is that you have different things to go to. That way, if one of the streams runs dry, you're not left with nothing, which could be very discouraging. You know, especially art is something that depends a lot on your confidence as a creator. If you're having a lot of negativity or you're getting negative results from, let's say you do an art show and you hardly sold anything, then you're not as disheartened if you have money coming in from other sources. But if the only thing you had was that show and it bombed, then it can shake you to the core.
Hmm. What are some of the other things that you learned while taking the business classes, and how you've kind of applied those lessons into what you're doing now?
One of the biggest things is to spend time doing the things you're good at. Develop those things. You know, I'm a proponent for you to develop your strengths. And that doesn't mean that you ignore your weaknesses. You try to mitigate those as best as you can, but I think it's important that you spend a lot of time on solidifying your strengths even more. And for example, right now, giving presentations like the one that you witnessed with the Central Florida Podcasters, I enjoy doing that, but I practice and I read and I try to become an even stronger speaker, because it's something that I think lines up with the things that I like. Like what I said at the beginning, I really like becoming a better version of myself, but in the process also inspiring other people to become a better version of themselves. And if I just become complacent in the fact that I can paint pretty pictures and I can speak in front of an audience and just become complacent about it, it sooner than later, I'm not as good as I thought I was, or I become careless. So I think it's important that for artists, you know, recognize, do a self-assessment. What are the things that you're strong at? What are the things that you see have potential for growth in your artistic career? And make sure that you put a lot of energy into those things. And we were talking recently about the expression jack of all trades, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And jack of all trades has a counterpart in the expression that is master of none. You want to be master of something. So pick the things that you can be strong at in your craft and develop them. Develop those until you can be recognized as the master. But just because you're focusing on that doesn't mean that you don't do anything else. You do more of that, but you can also diversify and do other things too.
I think a good example of that is actually the winding stairs, which I want to double up at and say that is an great example of what marketers call content marketing, which is like putting out information for people. And behind that is, oh, I also have paintings here too, yeah. Which is not, you're not directly selling to people because people don't like being sold to.
That's right.
It's providing information to people, and through that, they might become interested in what you're doing and see that you have artwork and be interested in buying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's true. And when I started the Winding Stairs, I felt that there was a need for that, for there to be a podcast where people could go and listen to that specific type of content. And since I was also creating art related to that content, it made complete sense that the source that would fund the production of the podcast would be the sale of the art. So when I'm producing the podcast, my focus, you know, again, compartmentalizing the different wearing of the hat. When I'm creating the podcast, I'm creating the podcast. I'm not thinking, what's the message that I can send so that I can sell more stuff? No, my focus is to help that listener, that person that I'm going to be talking to, that I can help them see what I learned. I can help them perhaps be more introspective and make some decisions that are going to affect the rest of their journey. And then at the end of the show, I'll let them know, you know, thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, here's how you do it. Go look at the art, make it a part of your life, and, you know, help me continue to share these messages with people. And people respond very well. It's almost like you're building equity with them. You're giving and giving and giving. I don't know if you've read Gary Vaynerchuk's
Jab, Jab, Jab.
Yeah, Jab, 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 Right Hook. And it's absolutely true. Your focus is to create things that are going to add value to people. And when it's time for you to sell something, they almost feel they really want you to succeed. They want you to continue making your podcast. They want you to continue speaking and painting. Therefore, when you're selling something, they back you up. So you're not asking as soon as you meet people. You're giving and giving and giving. Eventually, a good number of them will be your supporters.
Yeah, I think that's an element that many artists are missing from the formula, which is to, if not like provide value, to at least talk, create conversation, you know? It's not just, here, buy this painting, that's it.
Yeah.
Well, if you're trying to do that, unless your paintings are unbelievable,
right?
Which they may be.
They could be.
They're not going to connect with people on a level in which case you would be doing when you add that additional element. So if it's great already and you add that on top, it's almost like, here, just take my money and give me one of those paintings, right?
That's right. And sometimes people don't get it. Sometimes you make a painting and people right off the bat, they don't get the message. They don't understand exactly what you intended to say, or they don't connect with it. But the painting sometimes open that conversation and you get a chance to have a dialogue with them, and then they become enamored with your work because they understand what you were trying to do with it, or they can see it in a different light. I couldn't tell you how many times that's happened to me, especially with surrealism. Surrealism is not necessarily for everybody. You know, it's not like a mass market, everybody has it on their house because it looks pretty. No, surrealism, it has its market. But many times I would see people that would walk by one of my paintings and think or say out loud, oh my God, what is that? And because it was, you know, perhaps an impressive image that had some sort of you'll have to see them to understand why they would react like that. But it would take me to engage with them and say, you know, how did that painting make you feel? Like, what provoked that reaction? And engage them in a conversation right then and there. Especially, I'll give you a specific. When I went to, there's a big art show that happens in New York called Art Expo. And I went to Art Expo, I think it was in 2008. And this is a huge show. We're talking about hundreds of booths of artists, and this is where the collectors go, where the galleries go, where the publishers go to find the next best artist. So in contrast to a local exhibition where you might have 100 or a few hundred people visit, here we have thousands and thousands of people walk by the art, and the art had to capture their attention right then and there, because you had the competition of a couple hundred other artists. And it was so interesting to see when, as people were walking by and the paintings would catch their eye, you will have that unrestrained reaction, oh, that's nice, or, oh, what is that? And if I didn't react instantly and try to engage with them and ask them, I would lose them. They would continue walking and nothing happened. But countless times they were receptive to the engagement, and they would talk about the painting, and we're still connected. They still follow my work, or they own some of my work. And if I didn't have the disposition to have that conversation with them at that moment, they would have missed out on making my art a part of their life, and I would have missed out on the money. So,
I think an important lesson from that is, like, the human connection in art, not just the work itself. It's the ability to create conversations, like we said earlier, that adds to the art.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, you said it right. Is that human connection? And a lot of artists tend to be very independent. And it is important that you, as an artist, recognize that you're not complete. There are components that it doesn't matter how much you read, doesn't matter how much you do. There are components that you're going to be missing, and it is important that you find those components in your interaction with other people. And if it is a matter of developing your skills, there are people who are better than you at portrait painting, and it's imperative that you connect with them so that you can learn from them. If you're looking at the business side of it, there are other artists or other business people who know how to better market your work. And by just reading alone or trial and error, you're not going to be as efficient as if you actually connect with people that can do that or know how to do that and can help you take the business side of your art to the next level. And that has been a long process for me to learn that and implement that. Because I'm a loner. I'll be here in my studio, and I can be here all day long for, you know, 7 days of the week and have no human interaction other than, you know, a Skype call or something like that. And it took a long time for me to recognize, no, I need to connect with these other people that are going to complete me. They're the puzzle pieces that are missing in this whole big picture. Otherwise, I'm always going to be an incomplete masterpiece.
That's a good way to put it. Thank you. I also want to talk about the Gentleman's Brotherhood and kind of a rundown of what you plan on doing there and how this is different from what you're doing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Gentleman's Brotherhood, the vision of it is basically, it's open to everybody. I created it for men who want to become the best version possible of themselves, and people that value the importance of treating other people with dignity. And as I mentioned earlier, I've come across so many instances where people are just so abrasive to one another, where people are – has this happened to you where you walk into an establishment and you open the door for somebody and they walk straight in. They don't make eye contact with you. They don't say thank you. They don't even nod at you. Not that you open the door just to get their approval, but it's courtesy. It's something that should be natural to anybody. If someone opens the door for me, it should be natural for me to look at them in the eyes or smile at them or at least say thank you or at least a nod of the head. But so many times I come across people, I don't know if they feel entitled, I don't know what it is, but it's definitely an absence of common courtesy. And when I started the Gentleman's Brotherhood, I wanted to shine a light on those things and help people be mindful so that, for example, when a man actually when somebody opens the door for you, you remember the conversation that we had on the Gentleman's Brotherhood, and then you make an effort to actually make eye contact or say thank you. And when someone says thank you to you, you don't say, uh-huh, you know, or, you know, say, yup. No, when someone says thank you, you say you're welcomed. And these are basic things, but there are things that they show people that you really care. They show people that it matters to be decent to other human beings. So the Gentleman's Brotherhood, the concept began just as a blog, but it's steadily growing. Now we have I have a collection of podcasts that will be released soon. I only have one episode out that I encourage people to listen to. It's all available on thegentlemansbrotherhood.com. And in it, I give people an idea of what to expect from the Gentleman's Brotherhood, because it will be a membership, something that you can belong to. I will still provide content just like I did with The Winding Stairs. The podcast is always free. People can listen to the podcast. But I want it to be a community where people actually have a card that they carry in their pocket that says, I'm a member of the Gentleman's Brotherhood. And that component of that project I'm very excited about, because I can already imagine one day walking and seeing that someone has either a pin in their lapel and in their suit jacket with the symbol of the Gentleman's Brotherhood, and someone can recognize, oh, you know, that's a gentleman from the Gentleman's Brotherhood. So I see that happening in the near future, but for the moment I'm focusing on providing content, making sure that I clarify the vision so that people understand why we're doing this, because we really want to make sure that our kids have a lot of good examples to follow, that courtesy becomes common again, that people really take pride in being respectful. I don't know if it happens to you when you see these old movies and you see these gentlemen all dressed in three-piece suits with hats, you know, saying nice things to people, making sure they acknowledge people when they walk into a room, when they're holding the elevator door for somebody. They say thank you and ask please. I don't know. I'm just a romantic when it comes to stuff like that. I think I think it's so important for us to be able to model that for our kids. I want my kids to grow up and think that it's normal. I want them to see it as normal to show courtesy to people.
Yeah. I think that all speaks to the message that you're trying to send out in everything that you do, which I think is really important to remember. Everything that you do has an impact, like we said earlier again. And like, be sure everything that you do aligns with each other, or else people are like, what is this guy really about, right?
Yes. Yeah, most definitely. And I try very hard to live up to the expectation. I don't want to, you know, make up things. I really want to – this is the life I want to live. I want to be proud of the way that I behave with people. I want to make people feel I want to make a difference when I interact with people. I don't want to bring negativity to the room. And that's something that's important to me, that when I meet people, when I interact with people, I want to make sure that they feel better than when I first see them. I can't always make that happen, but
you're only human, right?
Another try.
I got a few more questions left.
Okay.
The first is, do you have a morning routine? And if you do, what is it?
My morning routine is something I've been tackling for a long time. I continue to tweak it and change it. But as of right now, as soon as I wake up, I go to the restroom, brush my teeth, do that thing. I make sure that I read. I'll tell you specifically what I do. Is I have a – oh, never mind. I turned off my phone. I have an application that I – it's like a checklist. I want to make sure that I make it a habit so that I don't miss any of the things. But basically, I get up, freshen up, and the very next thing that I do is I read. And I read the Bible. So there's a daily scripture that I read. And after I read, sometimes what I do is I play an audio version of the Bible as I'm preparing for the children to go to school. So I'm preparing their lunch bags and their uniforms. And I'm listening to scripture as that happens. I think it sets a good tone for the rest of my day. And then as I'm doing that, I have a little bit of a breakfast, take the kids to school, and when I return, I run. So I try to clock in at least 3 miles almost every day. But like I said, this is it's a system that I've that I try to modify and try to be consistent with. And after that is take a shower and come into the studio and straight to work. So that's what happens in the morning for me.
Cool. Do you have any books, podcasts, tools, or resources that you recommend to people? And if you have some for creativity specifically, that'd be awesome.
For creativity, first I'll tell you a book. This one is not about creativity, but it had a great impact in my creativity. And it is The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. Huh. That book came to my life at a moment where I needed it to be here. Have you ever read that?
I have, and I'm actually creating a quote art, which is what I do,
nice.
Based upon one of his quotes.
Oh, I love to see that. But it's a book that I've read at least three times now. But it came to me at a moment where I was making the decision of becoming a full-time artist. In 2004, I read this book after my mother had passed. She passed in February. Some things happened. I got injured. And in the process of recovery, I was reading this book, and I took it almost as, you know, this is the sign that I needed, and now it's time for me to start this journey to find that, treasure, find that life that I so desire. So, The Alchemist is a book that it's really made a big difference in my life. There is another book by Robert Greene that I absolutely love. And it's called The 33 Laws of Power, if I'm not mistaken. That book, I love history. I love history, and in it, he talks about different circumstances in history where power is evident. whether it's military power or social power. Anyway, it's a must read because you can see real life examples of people, how they overcome problems, how they left a legacy, how they were able to change their destiny by implementing those, one of those laws. And it's a I find it to be a very practical look at history. You're not just listening to a cool story. You're actually seeing how people were able to manifest change, lasting change in their lives by doing specific things. So that's a book worth reading. I don't read a lot about creativity. I know I have the left brain, right brain book. I started, but I never finished it. So I couldn't. I couldn't recommend it wholeheartedly.
Yeah, it's always. It's not really about, I guess, creativity, because creativity is all about pulling inspiration from different things, and your interpretation of what a book on creativity means is up to you, really.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah, those two books, those are two books that have had some solid impact in my life.
Cool. Awesome. Who is somebody that you know personally that is extremely creative, and then who is also someone that you know, who you don't know personally, who is also creative?
Somebody that is creative. Right now I'm really enjoying my son. He's 5 years old, and I can tell that he's inherited some of the artistic traits that I inherited from my mother. So these are two connected people that whose creativity inspires me. With my kid is because he really enjoys it. You give him a piece of paper and a crayon or a marker or something, and at his early age, he's just 5, he can create things that I recognize. I know what they are when he makes them, and I can see the improvement, and I can see his patience when he's coloring and he's so meticulous, and it inspires me, because that's one of the things that I don't want to lose as a creator, is having that being in awe of being able to create something. And from my mother, I really enjoyed the fact that she could create something out of nothing. That whether we were in one of the prosperous eras of our family, she could create. And when we were, you know, perhaps not as, I call them going through the skinny cows, when we were going through the skinny cows, she would still make sure that the dining table was decorated impeccably, and she would make something out of nothing. So that is something that has helped me in my career, because I don't always wait for things to be available. I make things available myself. So that helps. Huh. And you said someone that I don't know that's creative?
You know, yeah, someone you don't know personally, like maybe a celebrity, an artist that you admire. Yeah.
Okay. There are... Oh, that's a good question. I like that. Someone... Oh, my God. My favorite person right now, Casey Neistat.
Yeah.
Absolutely love his work. Casey Neistat is a filmmaker that lives in New York, and he creates short films. I can tell you know who he is, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the people that don't know who he is, go to YouTube and look for Casey Neistat, Neistat, and he inspires me. I see his work, and he's not a painter, and he does nothing that I do, but I watch his videos, and he acts as inspiration to me. I would love to meet him, by the way.
Yeah, he did a film for Nike in which they paid him to do like this commercial for them. And what he did was he took the entire budget and he's like, I'm not going to do what you told me to do. I'm going to do my own thing and see where this money takes me.
That's right. And it was an amazing video at the end.
It was awesome. And it actually was one of the top YouTube videos ever at the moment it was created. And it brought Nike a lot of great publicity, which goes to show you like what you can do with things, not necessarily going by the book.
Yeah. He wasn't confined by some parameters. They trusted his creativity. And that's a great place to be. When people can pay you and not be hovering over your shoulder, that's something I really enjoy from what I do. You know, when people commission me to do paintings, they give me an idea perhaps that they have in their mind, and they want me to make a painting of my own. And basically that's what happens with him. They want a project from him. They know that his creativity is so on point that it doesn't matter what he does at the end, is going to exceed the expectations.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just today wrote an article, and I talk about Michelangelo was commissioned by the Pope to do like a painting of the Sistine Chapel, but it was only supposed to be for 12 apostles, and that's pretty much it. But what he did was he just like, no, I'm going to do my own thing, and he ended up creating like 300 people in the chapel.
That's awesome. Yeah, he was someone special. I love Michelangelo.
The last question I have is, what is your definition of creativity, and what can people do to be more creative?
My definition of creativity is to be able to create something exceptional where you are with whatever limited resources you have. When you're able to connect to that inspiration, you can take what you have and create something that can really have an impact on people. I think that's for me, that's creativity. And one way in which people can be more creative goes back to one thing I suggested earlier. Make sure you make an assessment of the things that you're strong at. You have to be in tune with what you enjoy. And do that until the wheels fall off. If you like painting, just make sure that you're painting and painting, painting. And do as I say, not as I do, because I haven't been painting a lot lately. But in order for me to discover the painter that I am today, I had to make a lot of paintings. And also, don't limit yourself to your medium. I'm not saying go practice other stuff. I'm saying derive inspiration from other stuff. I become very inspired by filmmaking. And I'm not a filmmaker. I go to the theater, and I come out of the theater, and I paint. Or I draw. Or I create something for my business. So try to seek inspiration outside of the confines of your medium, because it expands your mind so exponentially. You give yourself an opportunity to think outside of the, thinking outside of the box. And the only way you think outside of the box is by every now and then peeking out of that box and seeing how things look on the outside.
That's a good point. Well, Juan, this has been really awesome talking to you. I think people are going to enjoy this because you got a lot of great things to say about like mindset and how you can use being a better person to become a better artist as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. It's been an honor to speak with you. I thank you for the time that you've given me on your show. And thank you for the listeners.
Yeah, where can people find you online and keep up to date with what you're doing?
Well, the main place that People can follow me if they go to thegentlemansbrotherhood.com, that you will see a lot of new things coming through there. I have, like I said, a podcast, a lineup of podcast episodes that are going to be published in the next couple of weeks. And you can also find me at thewindingstairs.com, where you can see the different episodes. If you're curious about the Masonic art that I create, just go to freemasonryart.com, and you can see I have original paintings, and I also make custom-made, hand-painted Masonic aprons. So that's something definitely you want to check out, freemasonryart.com.
Cool. Well, yeah. Thanks again for coming on, and we should talk again soon.
Kevin, it will be my pleasure. Anytime.
All right, bye.
Bye.
And that's it for the 39th episode of Cracking Creativity. For show notes, go to crackingcreativity.org/39. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes at crackingcreativity.org/subscribe. Also, feel free to write a review or leave me a comment about the show. Hope this stoked your creative fires, and I'll see you next time on Cracking Creativity.